A lot of folks are tuning in and sending me messages. They feel that my guest, David Aronovich, author of the book Voodoo Histories, must himself be a disinformation agent, some sort of an operative of the elite, the Illuminati, sending here to spread the message that we should pay no attention to the man behind the curtain or the cabal behind the closed door. I want to get into that with David when we come back after this break, as well as the JFK assassination, 9/11, and a lot more to come. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. David Aronovich, we're talking a little bit about somewhat ancient history. The same folks who used conspiracy theory to try to keep us out of World War I, I guess, punished and pummeled Franklin Roosevelt after the war, blaming him for getting us into it by using conspiracy theory. And then in your book, you describe how post-war the target sort of shifted, but the same tactic. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. Sorry, it being the season of Mr. Mellow Fruitfulness, I seem to have got one of these sort of early English coughs for the autumn. That was just me.
Oh, okay. Well, I hope you'll survive at least to the end of the program. I
well, this
wanted
is a
to.
great show, actually.
Well, we're having fun, and there's a lot more to come. I know a lot of our listeners want to beat you over the head right now. We'll give them the chance to do that later. I wanted to talk a little bit about McCarthyism because I thought this was a really good example in the book of where a conspiracy theory really does cause significant harm to individuals.
Yeah, it does. Although again, it's really very interesting this because what you have is a development out of, by and large, the same kind of people who've been fed up with America being involved in World War II and who've been very critical of Roosevelt, then have a tendency to be the people who construct what you kind of might call the full McCarthyism, which is not the notion that there have been communists in American government. There were one or two communists who got into American government, and Alger Hiss was indeed in the 30s a spy for Moscow. The American left has spent many years trying to say no, he wasn't, but we now have conclusive evidence coming out of the old Russian files and so on that indeed he was. But McCarthy built something much bigger than this. What McCarthy said was not that there were some of these people and that they were there in the 30s and the 40s, but he said that they were hundreds, if not thousands of them, dominating American government, directing American policy. And I think also earlier was the idea, even before McCarthy got going from the House Un-American Activities Committee, that they were also involved in Hollywood and so on. And the net result of the notion that this was quite such a tight-knit conspiracy was indeed that people lost their jobs because they wouldn't testify against their friends and so on, were effectively blacklisted. And so on. And there was a kind of mood of paranoia in many places, small towns and large towns in America and so on, which did have a malign effect upon the lives of people who had never really done any more than have an opinion or express some opinions about how the world should be.
And these people, a lot of these people really did suffer career-wise and in their personal
lives.
Oh,
sure. I mean, in some ways, strange ways, the way we know best in England is that America's loss was our gain. We got some of your best screenwriters and so on came over to England to work because they couldn't work in America. And actually, one or two of the kids' programs, when I was very small in England, that I liked the most were actually written by one or two of these blacklisted individuals. And we know that there were people who committed suicide, people who couldn't get jobs, people who lived for a large part of their time, for the next 10, 20 years, under the shadow of the accusation that they were treacherous and anti-American.
One of the things you mentioned a little bit ago, only in passing, were these programs that you saw, that were sort of the precursors to the Da Vinci Code, the story of the search for the Holy Grail, this great conspiracy about the true origins of the church. Let's talk about that for a little bit. Now, you delve into that somewhat. Go ahead.
Oh, no, this is so much fun. I mean, A lot of conspiracy theories are very, very, if you like, kind of very, very serious, heavy-going stuff, and they have big implications. Now, even I don't pretend that the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the Da Vinci Code has big implications for anybody. It's annoying to Catholics. And I can sympathize with them because of that, but it isn't actually, nobody's going to die as a result of it. But it really is a kind of fascinating example of the way in which a group of people built up over time, and the most incredibly complicated conspiracy theory involving history and so on. And it also showed something about our love for a particular kind of story. Now, you remember, George, at the beginning of the Da Vinci Code, right before he starts the story, he says, there are a number of things in this book that are true. You remember that?
Yeah.
He says, you know, the Priory of Zion and so on, you know, all this is true. That was all gleaned from a book called The Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which was a huge bestseller here in Britain. I think it sold very well in the States, too. And essentially, what that book claimed was that they had put together, from various bits of evidence, the evidence that there was a secret bloodline of Christ. In other words, that Jesus had married, that there had been a pregnancy, that Jesus's wife had fled to Gaul, to France, had settled down there, had had her child, that this had created the bloodline of Christ, which had been guarded down the centuries by a secret organization called the Priory of Zion, and which had now been uncovered by the authors of the book, The Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Now, how did this happen? Well, it happened because a guy called Henry Lincoln, who put this on the BBC in his documentaries, had been traveling through southern France, came across a paperback book, which was a history of a local cure or vicar or priest in a town called Rennes-le-Château, who had become mysteriously wealthy. And he had rebuilt his church, and he'd become wealthy, it was speculated, because he had found a secret parchment in a hollow pillar in the old church when he was rebuilding it. And on that parchment was a code. That code was lodged in the National Archives of France, and that code, when read, said something about Dagobert II, who was one of the Merovingian kings of France in the 7th century. And also, there were a series of other clues and geometric clues and so on, which led us inescapably to the belief that there had been this organization. The organization, too, was mentioned in the National Archives in France. And the leading members of this organization, the master of this organization, had included Leonardo da Vinci, Victor Hugo, Jean Cocteau, Isaac Newton, and several others. And this was put across, and this book was based on three documentaries which had originally been put into the BBC Chronicle series, which is its main historical program, during the course of the 70s, which is where I saw them, and they were fantastic. So that is, if you like, the kind of origin of that bit of the Da Vinci Code. Now, what I didn't know when I was absorbing all this stuff and reading that book was that the guy who made these programs, far from being a historian and archaeologist, was actually a writer of children's thriller programs for TV and an actor in what we call Hammer horror films, a minor actor alongside Boris Karloff. In other words, he had no historical or archaeological training at all. And it also became clear over time that he'd been hoaxed by a French hoaxer called Pierre Plantard, who had invented the Priory of Zion in 1956, not back in the Dark Ages. And all this was the stuff that went up to make the Da Vinci Code, and Lord knows how many other books besides, because these things became a publishing phenomenon, as these books often do, like the works of Erich von Däniken and so on. And it was really interesting to see how people would rather have believed this kind of things, and me to a certain extent included, than other very well-written history books, which are actually scholarly and far more truthful.
Well, it is an appealing story that Jesus' bloodline went on. You can see why people would latch onto that.
I absolutely love it. Although, when you started to think about it, the whole thing begins to fall apart, doesn't it? Because if you were born, let's say, the year 1000, let alone to the year 1900, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are in your bloodline. In other words, the bloodline of Christ by this stage would be really big. And it would take several priories of Zion to guard it, unless, of course, it was sort of, it had a kind of, I had to be careful here, but, you know, kind of deliverance level of inbreeding.
David,
we kind of attach all this whole thing to the Appalachians, and we really shouldn't, because it's not fair.
No, it's not fair. Let's talk about you for a minute. Now, what has been the reaction? This book's been out about a year. Voodoo History has been out about a year. What has been the reaction, both from your colleagues and from people who, for lack of a better term, are in the conspiracy theory realm? Other authors, the believers in various theories. Has it been pretty nasty?
It's quite interesting, actually. The other authors have been really very careful before taking me on. I mean, I've tried to get a number of debates with various people, and they haven't come off, because I think there are quite a lot of authors in this field who I think know that they have gone to the absolute far end of interpreting whatever evidence that they have available, and they're kind of unwilling to have it tested in public. But for ordinary people, I mean, I get a lot of emails saying, well, you're part of it. You know, you're just, you're part of the disinformation brigade. You're probably an employee of the CIA or MI5 or MI6. I had one guy turn up after one of the discussions I had, and he looked at me and he said, and I could see, and he almost had tears in his eyes. He said, why are you doing this? As if it was on a big other reason other than, you know, this is what I think and this is what I think that I've discovered. You know, there had to be something else in it. He really could not understand how anybody could hold the opinions and the views that I did. And then there have been a lot of people on the internet who've just said that I'm, called me every name under the sun. But we have also a movement here in Britain called the Skeptics Movement, effectively, which is very, very supportive. I mean, it's a pro-science and pro-rationality movement, very, very loose. It's, you know, it tends to be predominantly young, a lot of people who work in the sciences and so on. And they've been very supportive of what I've been doing, and I've been doing a lot of discussions with them. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there is a considerable constituency out there that just says, no, I don't want to hear what this guy has to say, or he's just got it wrong. And then, of course, because conspiracy theories change all the time, I mean, you know, they're always discovering supposedly new bits of evidence, and your capacity to debunk them always lags a little bit behind their capacity to produce the theory. There are always people that will be continuously saying, ah, yes, but what he hasn't mentioned is X, Y, and Z, and he hasn't gone into A, B, and C, and consequently you can dismiss what he says.
So have there been threats? Have they threatened you? Have you had people?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. I mean, some people said, you know, when this book goes into America, then you'll be in trouble, and, you know, all the crazies will come out to get you, and all this kind of stuff. I haven't found anything like that at all. I mean, all the argument has been rhetorical argument at the level of this game. I mean, sure, some of it has been a bit fruity from time to time. You know, by far and away, the most difficult conversation I've had was with a radio host from Los Angeles. I think she was very left-wing, who firmly believed in the 9/11 thing, and she had one of the 9/11 truthers on her program as well. And she was just thoroughly unpleasant to me, you know, just kind of, you know, really. But not in any kind of way abusive, and that's nearly the worst it's been. And so I'd love to be able to tell a tale, because I'm a journalist, of, you know, how brave I've had to be and how difficult it's been and how awful people have been. But the truth is, actually, that most people will engage, ordinary people, that is, will actually engage in this discussion, even if they think you're wrong. I mean, you know, conspiracy theories, by and large, still emerge from the intellect. In other words, they are matters of discussions of evidence and so on, and I find most theorists like that prepared to discuss. They're not, as I said, on the whole, stupid people.
I noticed that in your background, one of the honors you've won is the 2001 Orwell Prize for Journalism. Do you get hit with that? Because I'm sure that people say, Orwell, aha, doublespeak. There's the clue right there.
Well, I mean, Orwell, of course, was the inventor of the phrase
Right.
doublespeak
I know.
And newspeak and so on in 1984. And I won, you know, he was also a great promulgator of clear writing on political and other issues. And so, if you like, taking a sort of clear and lucid intellectual position. And I think in the citation, that was why they won it. But of course, to some people, Orwellian simply means the machinations of the state or a big brother society, and they believe me in some sense to be a defender of it insofar as I say the state was not responsible for 9/11. And so it's a strange kind of combination of things that leads people to make that accusation. But you're absolutely right, a number of people do say that.
You mentioned your skeptic society there in England. Is it affiliated with the various skeptics organizations over here? Because as I mentioned when we were first talking, there are skeptics and then there are debunkers. There are skeptics organizations that wouldn't believe anything no matter what evidence was presented to them, which to me to be a classic example or definition of skepticism.
Okay, well, that's really interesting because we've been, and I don't know where you'd place them, but for instance, the James Randi Educational Foundation is quite big. You know, we know quite a lot about it here. We didn't 2 years ago, but I think we do now, and that's felt to be quite important. There's the Skeptics Newsletter. I don't know where they fit in your in your group of people. And the news are, if you like, people who devote themselves or a lot of their time to debunking and skepticism because somebody's got to do it, because there is such a lot out there quite often to debunk. I mean, one of the problems with conspiracy theories, or let's take another example, since it's a form of conspiracy theory, the MMR. Do you call it that there, the measles, mumps and rubella jab?
The vaccination.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the conspiracy theories that ran over here, essentially, it was a bit like this, was that this caused autism in kids, and it was being covered up by the authorities or big pharma, you know, the big pharmaceutical companies.
We have talked about that on this program, yes.
I bet. And it, as a result of that discussion, enough people stopped giving their kid the jabs here to reintroduce measles into this country as a disease which we've actually eradicated 20 years before. And I think that was a wake-up call to an awful lot of people, because the discussion was anti-scientific. It was led by journalists, by and large, who didn't know what they were talking about. It had a kind of conspiratorial overtone, and some kids actually died as a consequence of it. And it was all totally unnecessary. And I think that, I'm sorry if I had a phrase here, gave a shot in the arm to the skeptics movement here in Britain. And I don't know how it is in the States, but I've seen, when I've been over, I've seen Jim Carrey and so on go on about MMR over there. And it is a kind of conspiracy theory. And, you know, you think this stuff has to be combated because it does have consequences for people.
You know, we'll talk about a couple of good examples, JFK being a primary one. And I know that there are those who, yourself included, who think that JFK can be explained in prosaic terms. But I also think that there are pretty good reasons why people would ask the questions in the first place. The weaknesses, there are some omissions, glaring omissions, I think, in the Warren Commission report. Plus, if you begin with the premise that a lot of people wanted JFK dead to begin with, including some people who operated here in my hometown, Las Vegas, some very bad characters associated with the mafia. And I know these larger schemes, the mafia, CIA, everybody sort of mixed together. But if you begin with the idea that there really were people who wished him harm, you can see where a conspiracy like that begins. And
yeah, you surely can. I mean, after all, people have been assassinated before. And I know it's a big question. We'll get into it in the next section.
Okay. But, well, we'll do that. We need to take a break. We'll jump into that and 9/11 as well, still to come. And maybe I can even drag you into a UFO conversation as well. We're talking with David Aronovich, author of Voodoo Histories. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM. David Aronovich, author of Voodoo Histories, is my guest. Still to come, a conversation about 9/11. Was it an inside job? We'll get into a little bit more detail about JFK. Could Oswald have done it alone? And then some conspiracy ideas and theories that maybe strike a little closer to home. Weapons of mass destruction, Iran-Contra, Big Pharma and its influence with the American Congress, things like that. Don't go away. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. David, talk to me about the Warren Commission report. How would you characterize that investigation? That was a good job or pretty poor?
It's really interesting. I mean, the first thing it says, it was huge, and it was very quick, far too quick. And consequently, it was both compendious. It threw an awful lot of stuff out there. There was some stuff which it couldn't get because it didn't have the full cooperation of the security agencies. But the important point that the Warren Commission report made at the beginning, I mean, essentially, the Warren Commission report, I think, in retrospect, was correct in almost all the things that it decided. But unfortunately, it lacked the capacity to convince an important section of American population, I think, because it was so quick. Now, we know But one of the reasons, or I think we know, that one of the reasons why it was so quick was that Johnson had been worried that there was a possibility that blame might attach to the Russians for the assassination of an American president. And after all, we're talking here only a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there were still huge concerns that, you know, a degeneration into war, which could lead to nuclear exchange, was still a possibility in that world. And this was one of the reasons why he got Earl Warren, he gave Earl Warren the job, and they decided to be so quick about it. But one of the things that the Warren Commission report points out, and it's really important to get this, is that America had at that stage had a long history of lone gunmen shooting at presidents and significant political figures. You know, it had happened, I mean, it had happened going way back. Even Roosevelt himself was shot at in 1933 in Miami by a guy, an anarchist, who'd gone to Miami for the dog races. He'd lost $200. Roosevelt was driving through with the mayor of Chicago, Anton Chermak, and he took a shot at them and hit Chermak. Now, in those days, 1933, you know, Huey Long was similarly shot in the same kind of period. People didn't construct great conspiracy theories at that stage around such shootings. It wasn't really until Kennedy was shot that you began to get this, if you like, very, very complex story superstructure added to what had happened. And I think I have some explanations as to why I think Kennedy in particular triggered such a series of notions about conspiracy, really, which we can go into if you want to. But the straightforward facts of the case, as far as we can see and can now reconstruct them, and by the way, can I recommend to you Vincent Bugliosi's enormous history of the Kennedy assassination, Reclaiming History? I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it. 1,600 pages. Every single conspiracy theory just about that there is dealt with factually in the case by the author, by the guy who also wrote Helter Skelter, the account of the Manson.
Right. Have you read Vincent Bugliosi's account of the weapons of mass destruction, the case for the
invasion? I haven't. That would sort of be another
conspiracy theory we could talk about, but I want to hold that. Before we leave JFK, you know, you talked about the lone gunman, histories of lone gunmen. Certainly, you go back even further. John Wilkes Booth wasn't a lone gunman, was he? That was a conspiracy,
no,
wasn't
it? He was part of a group of four or five people, a fairly sort of loose and small group. I mean, one of the things I think is going to be, by and large, tend to be true about these things, is that the more people who are involved in a conspiracy, the more likely it is to break down. In other words, the more kind of moving parts it has, the more complicated it gets. So there's a reason why lone gunmen tend to be more successful. I mean, after all, the CIA had on its books various plans to kill Castro, none of which could ever even remotely come to fruition, because simply because they were very, very complicated. On the other hand, there have been other conspiracies which have very nearly succeeded. One thinks of the plot to kill Hitler, which very nearly succeeded in blowing him up, but for a table leg in 1944. But there again, the group was fairly small, kind of six or seven people, I think, in total, who knew the details of that. So there's a reason why single gunmen tend to succeed. And the other point is they don't really care about being caught on the whole, because they're doing it for glory. You have, as I said, a long history of that. But that isn't sufficient in itself. What's sufficient in itself is to know, I mean, let me give you an example of the thing that I always thought established that this was a conspiracy when I didn't really know a lot about it, which is like the magic bullet, okay?
Right.
All the books that I saw when I was younger about the saying that Kennedy was a conspiracy, they all had essentially the same contention in it, which is that this bullet that is fired from the depository that hits Kennedy in the back and then exits through the wrist of Governor John Connally sitting in front of him was an impossibility. It's a ballistic impossibility. It couldn't have happened. It behaves.
And then the bullet comes out unscathed, and it's not even
nicked. And then the bullet comes out relatively unscathed. That's right. In fact, when you look and reconstruct where Kennedy was in relationship to Connally, how Kennedy sat, in other words, up and to the side to Connally, and how and look at the trajectory of the bullet from the depository, which you can now do using computer reconstruction. We have been able to do this for the last 10 years. That bullet isn't magic at all. It really isn't magic. It's a proper bullet doing what a bullet would do. Now, when you know that, then, you know, if you like, one of the major factual objections to the single gunman notion disappears. When you also know that Lee Harvey Oswald had earlier that year attempted and very nearly succeeded in assassinating another Dallas figure, General Walker, with the same rifle that he used, that was used in the Kennedy assassination, then you can see that you already have an assassin at large. At which point, the contingent question becomes, you know, the unfortunate question becomes, how it was that the motorcade was routed past the place of work of this particular guy. And that is the kind of thing that happens in life. You know, that's the kind of... but, of course, in a conspiracy theory, no such thing is possible. There can't be coincidence and there can't be accidents, accidents of this kind.
Yeah, I guess with Oswald, it's just that there are so many of those accidents in a row. How a guy like him comes back from Russia, is allowed back in, you know, and associations with really shadowy characters, including mafia guys and CIA guys. And then you add on Jack Ruby and the mob. And boy, it's a whole bunch of stuff that it really is an amazing series of coincidences. And
well, I don't know. It is an amazing story, that is for sure. But I don't know that it really is such an amazing set of coincidences. I mean, you're talking about this kind of, you know, this odd kind of marginal world, which isn't actually connected up. It's sort of disparate bits, you know, people off at different
margins. Well, actually, you mentioned the example of how it is connected up, and it happened right here in Las Vegas, where the mob, through a guy named, a guy who worked for Howard Hughes, a former CIA guy, contacted the mob, Johnny Roselli, to work for the CIA to help kill Castro. So, I mean, there are historical precedents where those kinds of people do work together on things of that magnitude.
You gave a really good example with Iran-Contra. Iran-Contra is a really good example of an attempted conspiracy, which is discovered. Now, it's discovered as it was bound to be discovered, in a way, because the fact is that people could find out that weapons were getting to the Contras, and they would follow the trail, and so on. But nevertheless, it is a good example. And I'm not saying that it is impossible that such a thing could happen, because that would be foolish. What I'm saying is that actually the problem you have with Kennedy, from the conspiracy theorist's point of view, is genuinely there is not a single piece of evidence for it. There really isn't. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about conspiracy theories, we had it with Diana over here in Britain,
sure,
is when the thing actually comes to a court, in that case it was the inquest, and the person putting the conspiracy theory has to stand the same kind of evidential test that all the rest of us have to face, that the official theory has to face, there is nothing. There is nothing actually there. There is nothing that they can produce which is evidence which can suggest, yes, this is what happened.
What do you make then of the House Assassination Subcommittee concluding that it probably was the result of a conspiracy? Not only that one, but Martin Luther King, that they were wrong?
Totally. Yeah, they were completely wrong. I mean, don't forget that they'd also heard, they saw auditory evidence about the sequence of shots, which turned out to be wrong, and the timing of shots, which turned out to be wrong. And they and there was this kind of series of, and there was also the kind of atmospherics of that particular time. One of the things I thought, and this is slightly tangential, I know, but one of the things I thought was interesting is fairly recently, a couple of years ago, we had a documentary on British TV about the death of Robert Kennedy. And the filmmaker had said that he had film that showed that there were all these kind of CIA characters walking around the hotel, the Ambassador Hotel, at the time that Robert Kennedy was shot in 1968. And he had people on, including people who had testified, I mean, leading witnesses at the House assassinations for the House Commission, House Committee hearings that you're talking about, and so on. And he showed them the film, and they said, "Yeah, that's so and so. He was a CIA agent. It shows this, this, and this, and this." Actually, it turned out, he then kind of checked with the LA police and so on. It turned out that these guys were not CIA agents. One that he thought was a CIA agent had actually died several years, 5 years earlier, of a heart attack. And the other two were salesmen for the Bulova watch company who were having their convention in the hotel on the same night. And yet this guy who had testified for the committee said, "Yes, solemnly, that's the so-and-so, and that's what we would expect to see if, you know, there were, if the CIA was involved," and so on. In other words, people, I mean, I'm not saying that people are insincere, although I think some people are insincere, but I think that particular process, official process, that committee at that time was actually flawed.
There's a friend of mine named Jim Mars who's been a guest on this program who's written about JFK. I'd love to have a conversation between the two of you. I think
He's
you'd
written about
enjoy talking to
everything.
him.
There's nothing
Yeah,
wrong with him.
he's a really interesting guy. He also is a pretty good journalist and knows a heck of a lot more about this than I do. I want to touch on 9/11 before we got about 10 minutes before the break, and then we'll be opening up the phone lines. I'm no expert on this at all. I've listened to some of the programs that have been done. I know a lot of people feel very passionately about it, and that there's a lot of, as in many of these conspiracy theories, it gets really big. The one thing that has really interested me as sort of a casual observer is the discussion of what appears to be, a controlled demolition and then traces of thermite. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, traces of nanothermite, I think
That nanothermite.
they claim, an explosive previously unknown to humanity, and which has the same trace components in it as you would get if you crossed an airliner with a concrete building, which of course they did. I mean, nanothermite was the absolute last, as far as I know. There might be something more. Is the last throw of the 9/11 truth movement, after all the other various things that they've claimed. Well, you know that the theories about 9/11 originally had two parts. There were people who believed that, like the theory about Pearl Harbor, Bush, etc., had known that there was a plot to attack America, but decided to let it happen on purpose, the LIHOP view. And this gradually was superseded in the conspiracy community by the MIHOP view, which was that Bush made it happen on purpose. And essentially, what they argue is that the planes were autopiloted into the Twin Towers, which had been pre-rigged with explosives to come down at the same time. God knows why. Don't I, you know, I. Why it wouldn't be sufficient to have the planes go into the buildings, I have absolutely, I have no idea. And this is for something for them to explain. That simultaneously, they also exploded World Trade Center Building 7, though they didn't fly a plane into this. Why? Again, I don't know. That a missile and not a plane flew into the Pentagon. This is despite the fact that there are hundreds of eyewitnesses of a plane flying into the Pentagon. But nevertheless, for some reason, this is what they hold. And that Flight 93, actually, far from being going down as a result of its passengers rushing the cockpit, was actually the one plane that was brought down by U.S. fighters. U.S. fighters, which had been deliberately delayed in scrambling to intercept the planes as a result of official interference, that consequently all the calls made from the planes by the passengers describing the hijackings, etc., were actually faked using voice morphing technology by persons unknown, in order to create a pretext to blame Osama bin Laden, to create a pretext for the invasion of Afghanistan and eventually Iraq. In other words, the most complicated, and I've looked at conspiracy theory, and I think the most complicated conspiracy theory really since the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. I mean, really, really complicated.
Of course, it was a conspiracy that brought down the World Trade Center.
It certainly was. It certainly was a much simpler conspiracy. And a conspiracy, actually, whose very simplicity was probably the key to its success, actually.
I want to go back to this nanothermite thing, because I hadn't heard it. Like I said, that was the one part of this story that sort of caught my attention as an outside observer, is finding traces of this stuff. But your take on it, it is not thermite. It's something called nanothermite, and that could be created.
That's what the conspiracy theorists say. I mean, there was a National Geographic program that I took part in that was broadcast in the States, I think about a year and a bit ago, which looked at the substance thermite itself and showed how it wouldn't bring anything down in the way that was suggested. So they've invented this kind of notion of nanothermite, this special, extraordinary type of explosive that only the U.S. military has access to, which has trace elements in it, certain oxides and so on, which are found at the scene of Ground Zero, as discovered by one or two chemists, with material that was sent to them several years later by members of the conspiracy community. Now, the big problem that has been pointed out by people to this is that the same is, firstly, that there was significant contamination of the samples, but secondly, that what the sample showing them is nothing that you wouldn't expect if an aluminium airliner went into a large amount of concrete, into a concrete building, essentially the same compounds. But even, in a way, one is kind of dignifying a kind of absolutely ludicrous assertion in this, which is that somebody, in order to bring this situation about, had sent in great, teams of explosives and demolition experts to rig up these buildings without anybody noticing, without anybody ever coming forward and saying so, etc. Timed them to coincide with the autopiloting of these aeroplanes into these buildings, when actually there is a perfectly good scientific explanation of how the planes going into those buildings brought them down, available, widely accepted amongst the engineering community, and so and therefore, you don't need any such theory. So what I'm really looking at in the case of 9/11 is the desperate desire that the people who have this theory have for it to have been Bush's fault rather than Osama bin Laden's fault. The real big desire they have for it to have been him who did it and not the people who actually did do it.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who still harbor a great animosity toward President Bush and that administration, in part because what happened after 9/11. I don't know if you would call this a conspiracy, but if the administration discards evidence that suggests that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, promotes the idea that they did, and then promotes the idea that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, again, ignoring evidence to the contrary that they have in their possession. Do you characterize that as a conspiracy? Your government participated in it?
No, I would. I certainly wouldn't. I think all the intelligence agencies believed, the British, French, American, and Russian, believed that Saddam Hussein still had weapons of mass destruction or programs to create them. And they were absolutely astonished when nothing was found. Now, what we're talking about here is something different. We're talking about confirmatory bias, something called confirmatory bias. And it's a very, very important. It is that if you have an idea in your head, you intend, or a political preference sometimes, you tend to interpret every evidence in favor of it and overinterpret it,
right.
And you tend to discount every bit of evidence against it. The guy had used weapons like this before, therefore he was
right.
Going to be, de facto guilty, he'd use them again.
Okay, well, very interesting. We're talking with David Aronovich, author of Voodoo Histories. We're going to open up the phone lines, and I know a lot of you folks are going to want to have questions. David, hang in there. A lot more to come. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.